for the innocent blood that they shed every day. Oh, children, mark my word, it's what the Bible.
That's the incomparable Robert Nesta Marley with We and Dem from his 1980 album Uprising. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Tuesday, August the 26th, and I want to come back to our continuing theme about where we are in the scheme of things. The two cases that have come to crystallize our concern about the collective of the African American and Latino communities particularly, but we're talking about the United States as a whole. That is the chokehold death of Eric Garner in Staten Island on July the 17th, and on August the 8th, the shooting death in Ferguson, Missouri, Michael Brown. As you know, the funeral was held yesterday for Michael Brown, and this is in part what the Reverend Al Sharpton had to say in his eulogy.
It's time to deal with policing. We are not the haters, we're the healers. What does it require of us? We can't have a fit. That's right. We got to have a movement. Right. A fit, you get mad and run out for a couple of nights. A movement means we got to be here for the long haul and turn our chants into change, our demonstration into legislation. We have got to stay on this so we can stop this. We need the Congress to have legislation about guidelines in policing. We need to have a fair, impartial investigation. Michael Brown must be remembered for more than disturbances. He must be remembered for this is when they started changing what was going on. Oh yeah, there have been other times in history that became seminal moments. And this is one of those moments. And this young man, for whatever reason, has appealed to all of us that we've got to solve this.
Well, very, very apropos words, I imagine. And what we need to understand by what he just said, Reverend Sharpton just, in fact, without people being conscious of it, just launched his perennial voter registration drive for the Democratic Party, talking about the long haul. But let me get to that in a minute. First, I need to talk about leadership and what we ought to expect of leadership now and of ourselves as those who follow leaders. The old paradigms have got to end. They're no longer tenable and they're no longer useful to the community. To say that, and I just get fed up with the idea that time and again, the administrative reforms in institutions like the police departments and so forth, administrative reforms come at the expense of people's lives. And it invariably involves African American and Latino men mostly dying in order for the country to come to its senses about what reforms are needed. This is not Reverend Sharpton's first run around the block on this particular question. So in as much as he is available and is making himself available in a leadership capacity to lead these efforts for, quote, justice, unquote, which still has not yet been defined, we expect by now, given the statistics of the regularity of these occurrences, that the approach should be other than we need a movement. No. You don't need a movement. You need some movement. 6 weeks have gone by in the Eric Garner chokehold case. I continue to point to the fact there is not one single legal brief, not one piece of paper filed in a court of law anywhere that says that the leadership of this effort that is clamoring publicly for justice is insisting that A, there be the appointment of a special prosecutor in this case, and nothing else will do. That the district attorney, who, as we had discussed earlier on with Alton Maddox as our guest, who has decided that he can declare a, quote, special grand jury, and we know that that is not within his purview to do, and that a special grand jury will hardly be taking a look at the homicide as a case in which there ought to be an indictment for homicide, but rather than that, a special grand jury would be more interested in administrative reforms that will go to the legislature for changes in law where applicable, and it becomes all theoretical, and it becomes all an avoidance of this, the simple matter and the stark matter. Who killed Eric Garner, and who is responsible, and who will pay? It's as simple as that. To say in 2014 that there's some magic formula about policing that no one has grasped is to insult the intelligence of everyone. They've spent millions, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, perfecting policing policy. We are beyond that. This fact has to be front and center. This is not about helping the police departments to function in their repressive role more efficiently. This is about calling them to task for dispatching people from this earth with alarming regularity and with alarming impunity. But in order to do these things, Reverend Al Sharpton has to, in fact, come close to jeopardizing the cozy relationships that he has forged in recent years, and particularly in recent months, that have made him a valuable asset. To call for a special prosecutor, he's going to have to put the governor of the state of New York on the spot. The governor of the state of New York will have to remove the district attorney of Staten Island from the jurisdiction in this case, order the attorney general of the state to, in turn, put a special prosecutor in charge of this investigation. Nobody wants to do that. The governor doesn't want to do that. The attorney general doesn't want to do that. And Al Sharpton does not want to cause grief to the governor and to the attorney general, both of whom are Democrats. He's very close now to the president. He's very close now to the Democratic Party. So all of this bluster, I'm not even dealing with the demonstrations and whatnot. It's great if people want to have a demonstration, cause thousands of people to assemble in front of empty concrete buildings on a Saturday when the chief actors who need to see you and hear you are not even there. So you literally are howling at the wind. If that's what you want to do, good. I'm saying somebody needs to pay attention to the fact that this late in the game, and this is a very, very, this should be one of the most experienced leaders in this country dealing with these kinds of crimes, and therefore dealing with the clear-cut solutions that are available and that can be undertaken right away. There's no need to wait. 6 weeks have gone by. We see no legal action, no record of an intent even to confront the system in terms of the legal rights of the individual and the public interest in protecting those rights. So now to say to people, well, we need a movement. It recalls what Barack Obama said standing in front of the Lincoln Memorial, telling black folks 50 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act that it's a long road to equality. Telling and having people cheer and agree with that nonsense. No. That's why you're there. You can either do the job or you can't. There is a very narrow window of time. We're hearing the district attorney of Staten Island saying that he's going to convene this special grand jury. No opposition, no question, no checks and balances being proffered here by Sharpton and the lawyers involved, who are primarily interested in the civil side of the case. And that is a shocking concern. I contrast that with how Martin Luther King used to operate. Martin Luther King, in the process of leading contentious demonstrations over what was then called civil rights, but what we will now respect today as human rights issues, had at the ready a battery of lawyers. Even before he got into town, he knew exactly what the situation called for, and the lawyers were set to work on confronting all of the impediments to democratic rights even before the marches began. Whether it is filing for an injunction, whether it is contesting local ordinances, whatever it was, they were engaged in legal battle, and they didn't have the money. They certainly didn't have the kind of money Al Sharpton has as a president of the Madison Avenue Initiative. But 6 weeks have gone by. There has been no arrest made in this case. There has been no declaration at all from anybody that they're about to make an arrest. And it's about, well, let's have some more marches and see if the system is willing to listen to us. That hogwash has got to stop, and we've got to expose it. It doesn't even fly as a logical argument in 2014, not for somebody who has been through this time and again. You ought to know what is required. If you're not able to produce it, don't get involved. Or tell people why. you're not prepared to take on the responsibility of leadership and publicly ask. There's no shame in saying, these are the things we have to do. I don't have these skills. I don't have anybody with these skills, but these skills are needed. Can any attorney experienced in these matters come forward and assist us? Because we have to file these papers immediately. That's the first order of business. Never mind the demonstrations howling at empty concrete buildings. Justice demands you produce evidence that you're interested in getting it. In the situation in Ferguson, and I said symbolically yesterday that the city of St. Louis, of which Ferguson is just a suburb, the city of St. Louis is where Dred Scott is buried. Dred Scott, the epicenter of the foulest U.S. Supreme Court ruling that ever was, that the black man has no rights that the white man need respect. In 1857, and the symbolism of a funeral being held in Ferguson in 2014, predicated on the same premise of 1857, that this young man had no rights that this white police officer felt that he needed to respect. And this town had no rights that its residents should expect that those who they pay to police their communities have a right to respect. But when you are serving different masters, you come before the people and you get them into, oh, we have to change chance into change and all of this. And you know what this is all leading up to? It's a cynical observation, but I think it is dead on. It is all leading up to the announcement of the grand aggressive voter registration drive. Coming back to the churches, the black churches, to mine the black churches of their votes, to be given to the same Democratic Party that has held cities like Ferguson and boroughs like Staten Island in veritable slavery and servitude all these years. There is no evidence that Sharpton and his legal team have gone toe-to-toe in legal, in court, not another piece of paper filed, that served notice on the Democratic governor of Missouri, Governor Jay Nixon, that we will fight you on this. You must appoint a special prosecutor. Instead, the governor was so adamant, he was so confident in his white supremacist way of thinking, he told an entire collection of black elected officials of Missouri at a meeting on Sunday, I have no intention of changing the script. I am sticking with the same guy that you are suspicious of. He is going to prosecute the case. Yes, I know there are all kinds of seeming contradictions here, but I am confident in him. And if I am confident in him, the hell with you. He told them that. And there was no response. And it's now 3 weeks since this young man is dead. Never mind all the clapping and the hooping and hollering. That is not what changes things. Where the fight belongs, Sharpton is absent. His legal team is absent, and there's cause to worry because a whole different agenda is going on here, and it is sucking up the oxygenated blood, slightly anemic, but it's still oxygenated, of black folks. You trust in me. Trust that I will do the right thing. Trust that I have what it takes. And what is the trust based on? The fact that you can get television cameras to show up? That you can get people to hit the streets? No. That's to trump up and shore up your other agenda. You're now the go-to guy. You're in the perfect place. You're in the catbird seat. The black folks want you to save them, and the white folks want you to save them from black folks. Perfect. You can take the heat off the president. You take the heat off the system that ought to be called into account, and you're the minister without portfolio. You can do whatever you wish because everybody recognizes you now as the king of the blacks. But you're falling down on the job. And the evidence is that you are not measuring up, nor do you seem interested in measuring up to the battle at hand, because to do so will necessarily cancel out quite a few of the bennies that you now enjoy. And take a very small thing happened at this funeral yesterday, and it kind of went over a lot of people's heads, but not mine. You are at MSNBC. Great. Which, by the way, is third in the ratings of the cable news networks, consistently lagging behind. But who gets the exclusive right to broadcast this and to be the feed, the pool feed for what the entire world sees of this event? NBC. You would think, well, the Reverend Jackson knows that at least there's at least one black network. At least one. But NBC gets it, and NBC gets it because NBC, lagging behind, could use a boost in its ratings. And if it gets a boost in its ratings, particularly among blacks, it then begins to understand how valuable Reverend Sharpton is to the lineup. He can produce black eyeballs looking at your programming, while NBC absolutely refuses to cover the black community on a regular basis in any city. I doubt even his own staff is properly diversified. I'd like to know how many black people actually are in decision-making positions with regard to his own production. And the New York Times, the gray lady that has historically ignored all communities of color until there's something particularly pathological to report, gets the exclusive to provide pool photography. You would think there isn't a black photographer in the entire country who could operate a camera. You see, so in these small ways, people indicate where their heads are at. And it's in reverse or neutral, but it ain't in drive, that's for sure. So the leadership has to be called into account. Don't tell me today in 2014, these incidents are brand new experiences that must be treated as such. In fact, Reverend Sharpton ought to be the author of the playbook on this, the author of the manual on how you deal with political systems when these things happen, because they happen so often, and because you've been called to lead in these circumstances so often. But you're going to stand up in front of thousands of people and tell them what we need is not direct action now, is not to exercise the options that we have now, is not to confront the systems now, but what we need is a movement, which of course will take time to build and to reach that point of critical mass. It was the height of, I can't even find the word for it. Contempt is too mild a word. So I'm saying, 6 weeks from Eric Garner's death, to this day, no evidence of the intent for a legal fight on this matter, which is where the action is. It is not about sitting across tables from the governor and the apparatus, the oppressive system, and coming up with private accommodations behind closed doors. It is sending an incontrovertible signal that you're ready for battle, and you are battling in the name of the same people that you asked to brave the heat and the sun and come out and howl at empty concrete buildings on a Saturday, when the culprit, the person who should be on the receiving end of that wrath, is conveniently home someplace in air-conditioned comfort, couldn't care less about you. If we're going to change, let's change. And the chance is now. The chance is now. The chance is long gone. 6 weeks in Eric Garner's case, 3 weeks in Michael Brown's. To operate as if you have all the time in the world, to operate as if this is about the gradual process, this is about gradualism, then you should disqualify yourself, recuse yourself from leadership, and hand it to somebody who knows what they're doing or has the courage to do what needs to be done. We'll take this break and come back to our guest in the second half of this program, right after this. Could the Islamist insurgency in the entire Middle East and North Africa and repeated interventions by Europe and the West be setting the stage for an apocalypse of global proportions? It's quite possible, says our guest. And our guest is Dr. Nafiz Ahmed, renowned investigative journalist and international security scholar, who actually posits the idea, the theory, in a chilling sci-fi thriller, Zero Point, that was released last week, and he joins us today. Nafiz, so good to have you with us today.
Thanks, you, Trace. It's a pleasure to be on your show, finally.
You see, here's the thing. I think you confuse New York with London, where you just tell a cab driver where to take you when you get there. In New York, you have to become a co-driver.
Yeah, well, I made the mistake of thinking that I understood the metro system because I can't. And I don't, but I figured it out now after about a week. So.
Well, I'm so glad that you're with us. I'm so delighted. Well, I'll tell you why I am delighted. I'm delighted because of your work. You have done extraordinary work in making the links between what you know we see as these conflicts, the oil crisis and the fight for fossil fuels, the shift in paradigms, east-west paradigms. You bring these things all together, the environmental crisis, political activism, covert operations, all of these things you bring together in the stories and the reports that you have filed and in the documentaries that you have made, most particularly in the documentary The Crisis of Civilization, in which you brought it all together so well in 2010. I am delighted to have you and honored that you are a guest today.
Well, I'm very pleased to be able to speak to you about all of these things, and it's definitely wonderful to be on your show.
Well, let's talk about the odd placing of your theory, the crystallization of your theory in the form of a sci-fi thriller. I mean, how did you do that, and why did you do that?
Well, I did it because I felt that it was important to reach out to, you know, I feel like as activists sometimes there is a danger that occasionally we end up speaking to our existing constituencies and not speaking to the wider constituencies which need to be informed, but unfortunately may be too caught up in the kind of the whirlwind roller coaster of consumer culture, which all of us are involved in, embedded in, and partake of to some extent. And as someone who partakes of, you know, sci-fi geekery and action thrillerdom, you know, and I confess to kind of, you know, loving films and movies and music, and like all of us, I felt that it would be, you know, here's an opportunity to actually, I've always wanted to write a novel. I had some time about 6 years ago to start thinking about doing it seriously. So I wanted to write something that would really basically be very mainstream. It could, you know, anybody could pick it up and read it. They'd read it for fun, for entertainment, but in doing so they'd actually get a glimpse not of a kind of a fake Tom Clancy-esque espionage world, which is very black and white and very simplistic, but rather get a real taste of what actually is going on in the world. So I thought, if I write a novel, a story that's actually inspired by my journalism, inspired by what could happen in the near future, but obviously thrown in with a dose of interesting speculative fiction, it would actually be a very interesting way to not just explore some of these issues, some of these very difficult issues that we see in relation to, you know, the business as usual, where we're likely to be in the next few decades, in terms of the dangers of foreign policy and the kind of the blowback effect that we have at home and the resort to mass surveillance and the impact that we're seeing in terms of increasing civil unrest and growing inequality and all the rest of it. I thought it would be all of this stuff which is actually happening now, would actually be really interesting ingredients for a story that, using the medium of fiction, would allow us to explore some of these difficult political and ethical challenges that we're now facing. So that's why I decided to write a novel. And obviously, my intention was to try and reach kind of a broader audience.
Well, the hero, David Ariel, in Zero Point, is out to stop quantum apocalypse. Could you describe what that is?
Well, I mean, I don't want to give too much away because
too much.
Because that's obviously going to be part of that's a lot of that stuff is part of the story which unfolds. So, but to put it very, 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 very simply, what we find happening with this character, David Ariel, who starts off, you know, it starts off as kind of being your typical action hero type persona. He's an ex-military guy. He's currently working in specialist protection for the police, and he's on the escort unit which protects the Prime Minister while he travels around London and goes to meetings and things. So it all sounds very kind of like this is a typical kind of action hero you might get in any kind of normal Hollywood flick, for example. But where it goes down a different route is that David Ariel is actually he was a veteran of the what in the book is called the Fourth Iraq War. So it's set in the near future, and there's already been a US and UK reinvasion of Iraq to put down an Al-Qaeda insurgency in order to kind of protect our interests in regional oil resources. So he's a guy who's come out of that. He's been disillusioned with war, and in fact, he was a whistleblower, and he finds that this kind of that what he's doing at the moment in the police is the best way he can use his skills without getting involved in killing people or direct indiscriminate violence. But what ends up happening is that the Prime Minister gets assassinated on the streets of London, effectively under Ariel's watch. And he ends up being fingered in a way or kind of made a semi-official suspect of how the whole thing went wrong, and that causes him to go on this journey to try and understand what actually happened and what was going on. And when we go through into that story, the story opens up into a number of different directions. One of them, obviously, is looking at the role of blowback, the engagement of our intelligence agencies with international terrorist networks, especially these very virulent Islamist networks. So, you know, there's lots and lots of my own journalism went into the story in terms of looking at how our allies in the Gulf states, Saudi, Qatar, Kuwait, and so on, have been covertly sponsoring the very Islamist groups like ISIS, which are now rampaging across Iraq, and that they've done that effectively with our support. So it explores a lot of those kind of difficult geopolitical questions, but it also goes into stuff on the quantum apocalypse side. It goes into stuff that a lot of people aren't aware of, which is the secret history of intelligence agencies and their efforts to actually weaponize quantum physics, which isn't very well known. But one of the sources that I draw on is actually a close friend of mine who used to work in the British defense industry as a physicist, and actually was head of a number of programs to kind of attempt to weaponize quantum physics. And this guy was also used as kind of the deep throat source for a separate nonfiction book by a journalist called Nick Cook, who you can Google. The guy is a very, very senior, credible guy. He used to work with Jane's Aviation in Jane's Defense Review, one of the aviation journals of the Jane's Intelligence Group. And he was a senior editor there. He's now kind of an aerospace consultant. So he wrote this really interesting book called The Hunt for Zero Point, which looked at these secret efforts by first the Nazis and then later on the US government in particular to kind of pursue how they could weaponize these very, very startling new theories in quantum physics, which offered the potential to harness immense forms of energy for not actually putting very much energy in. You could get huge amounts of energy out. So this was all very theoretical, but it's actually what we know now is that this kind of military experiments were actually going on, but we don't know exactly what happened with them. So I draw on a lot of that information. Some of it is classified, some of it is basically leaked into the public record, some of it is very speculative, and some of it is downright hocus-pocus nonsense. But I kind of weave it into the story to take a kind of plausible investigation of you know, give it a very interesting kind of setting of really explore this question of technology, really. Can technology, even if we had an unbelievably powerful technology that could conceivably solve all of our energy problems, but could it really? Is technology really the answer? And my book really explores the contention that actually, you know, technology alone can't save us. Even if we had, you know, kind of a magic bullet, it's the politics and the geopolitics and the economics and the interests and the racism and the different cultural kind of conflicts, all of these different things which are what's preventing us from finding solutions. It's not just about technology.
Well, I mean, you've been extremely modest so far about your own academic credentials and the authority you bring to the subject. You've done quite a bit of work on international studies and also on international security issues, and you have done some seminal work in getting people to understand, in fact, that at least NASA had contemplated already an apocalypse, saying that they had put together all of the component parts that are possible and that can possibly create an apocalypse, and basically have come up with an idea that we're not too far away from this actually happening. But let me ask you to draw on your journalistic skills a bit, and taking a look at what the most recent developments have been in the Middle East, as it's called, in North Africa, where we see the rise of this Islamic movement, very virulent and brutal form of it, but also very powerful. And with that, you isolate and you particularly point to U.S. and UK, the United Kingdom, repeated interventions as being a possible triggering mechanism for a kind of apocalyptic occurrence. Could you talk about that?
Well, there's a lot of, there's a lot of evidence that the rise of ISIS was easily kind of predictable, and in fact, is a, you know, the very phenomenon of ISIS or whatever you want to call it. I mean, now it's just IS and or the Islamic State. So whatever you want to call it, there's a lot of evidence that everything that we've been doing in the region in terms of sponsoring various Islamist factions linked to Al-Qaeda since around 2004, if not somewhat earlier, by some accounts, has actually spawned and directly created, you know, the kind of Frankenstein monster that we now see rampaging across Iraq in particular. And this strategy really began, you know, it goes back many decades, really. I mean, it's kind of continued seamlessly. But, you know, after the end of the Cold War, we were told that, you know, we're going to separate and sever from Osama bin Laden. And we have no interest anymore because, we've defeated Russia effectively. But in fact, the Cold War, in a way, never really ended. And there are a number of CIA officials. There is an interesting book called Dollars for Terror, for example, by a well-known Swiss journalist, Richard Lebivier, who interviewed a CIA officer who told him that actually we felt that, we should still continue to use and fund the forces of Islamism in regions like Central Asia in order to counter Russian and Chinese influence. So that kind of mindset is what has been behind the continued support to elements of this group after the Cold War. And, you know, we've had very credible reports from people such as Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker talking about how the Bush administration really accelerated this policy to counter Iranian influence, obviously the next in line in the axis of evil. And that funding to Sunni militant groups has ended up going also to Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in many different countries, from Lebanon, Balochistan, which is a disputed kind of territory, neighboring Pakistan. Also, even in Iraq as well, we had this policy continuing. So, and there's lots and lots of detail in this kind of story that I've documented elsewhere in a number of different articles for The Guardian, for Foreign Policy in Focus, and many other places which people can check out. So that's kind of the background. The danger is where this is going, and how to interpret the role of the US and the UK right now. And it's difficult to say whether there are elements of the establishment that having created this mess now see it as an opportunity to pursue long-standing neoconservative dreams to remake the Middle East. But there is no doubt that there are people who are in powerful positions in parts of the military-industrial complex who also hold powerful positions in the Obama administration, but who do not necessarily represent even the mainstream average kind of thinking in those institutions, but nevertheless are in key positions to try and push forward their narrow agenda. And we can get a glimpse of that narrow agenda from looking at bits and pieces of evidence, such as there was a RAND report that came out in 2008 that was commissioned by the US Army to explore US counterterrorism options in the Middle East. And it very candidly set out that, it said a number of scenarios that they could pursue. And some of these scenarios were very, very disturbing. They openly referred to the idea of divide and rule. They openly advocated the possibility of shoring up the Gulf states, despite the fact that they're tyrannies, despite the fact that they are funding Salafi jihadism, simply because that they have the overarching control over regional oil and gas resources. And even worse, there was a strategy of funding both sides in the kind of Islamist spectrum in order to have them fight each other. And that involved actually funding Al-Qaeda affiliated Salafi jihadists, and when I use that phrase, that I'm quoting the document, funding these Salafi jihadists in order to have them fight with other Iranian supported groups, and then the idea was that they would all kind of somehow kind of fizzle out and fight each other and become much weaker and have less focus on the United States. So however we look at this kind of strategy, you know, whether we think it's overall, you know, well-intended but ridiculously stupid and short-sighted, or whether we think that there is some slightly more kind of narrow parochial vested interest involved, and I think it's probably both in different ways. Either way, we see that these kinds of trends are leading to a situation where the Middle East is heading towards what could very well be a conflagration. I mean, this group basically doesn't want to stop in at Iraq. It has ambitions to conquer the wider Middle East, as well as even to go as far and as wide as it says its ambitions are, Europe and North America. It's also been described as one of the most well-funded terrorist networks in modern history. So it is very worrying. And when we look at the ambitions of the group and we look at the ambitions of the neocons, and not only do we find that there is a kind of parity, a very disturbing parity, you know, we have the neocons talking about breaking up the Middle East in order to kind of access oil and gas resources, and they justify this in the name of democracy. At the same time, we've got these crazy Islamist extremists talking about setting up their caliphate, and rampaging across much of the world. So we have these two groups of mad people, basically, trying to control the region, both of them thinking that they're enemies, but actually effectively are, in a way, almost working hand in hand.
And, of course, the corporate interests. I noticed you left them out.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and the corporate interests are, of course, very much embedded in all of this, and certainly the neoconservative interests are hugely intertwined with corporate interests. And I mentioned the role of the military-industrial complex. But we ask ourselves, who is benefiting at the moment from, you know, for even say the current airstrikes that we've had in Iraq? At the moment, sadly, actually, that many of the ethnic groups who are under threat from this Islamist ISIS network in Iraq are not being protected by the limited form of US intervention that we've had so far. Instead, that intervention was focused, as many analysts have observed, has focused on protecting the Kurdish state. It's not a state yet, but the Kurdish autonomous autonomous administration, and has focused on ensuring that the oil region in Kurdistan is basically stable, and that the American and British and other contracts that are in place there aren't therefore jeopardized. And many other people have pointed out that the way in which the US and the UK are continuing to handle this crisis, again, is very much not about trying to solve the both short-term and long-term difficult issues in Iraq, many of which we have actually contributed to, the problems with democracy and corruption and paternalism, nepotism and all of that stuff, which is really a legacy of the occupation and the way in which we have, and the kind of people that we've attempted to bring to power in Iraq. Instead, it's focused very much on rehabilitating the current system, rehabilitating who we can in Iraq in order to kind of make sure that we play off different sides, play off the Baghdad central government against the Kurds in order to weaken the control of the different sides and ensure that our access to Iraq's abundant oil and gas resources remains the kind of the steady focus of everything we're doing there. So that short-sighted strategy is what is actually going to make this worse, and it's only going to mean that, you know, the more we're going to use these very quick, short-sighted military intervention, bombing for the sake of our interest approach, all that's going to happen is that we're going to end up demonizing locals. We're going to end up making people in Iraq feel that they do not have any friends, they do not have any supporters internationally or domestically, that the government that we have supported, which is actually a very, very Maliki's regime, has been a very sectarian government. It's been highly economically unequal. It's, you know, privatized infrastructure, and it's, you know, essentially trying to open up its oil industry to foreign investors without any real concern for the domestic population. And that's why in places like Fallujah and elsewhere, we've had, you know, large numbers of Sunnis. When ISIS have come in, they haven't objected. And this is the key thing, is that if we want to deal with this group, we need to understand that guerrilla warfare doesn't just come out of the blue. It comes on the basis of being able to move around with the support of the civilian population. The only reason the civilians in Iraq would support this group is not because they're all crazy fundamentalists, but purely because they're disenfranchised, there's no jobs, there's nothing to live for, and they've been living like this for decades. And now, in that context of a growing humanitarian crisis, a growing economic crisis, when people come in with very virulent and extremist ideas, it's a very well-known social dynamic that they end up having much more traction. So it's very important that we deal with the root causes rather than just dealing with these dealing with the surface symptoms.
A central entity in all of this is Israel. How do you read Israel's role in this Islamic insurgency?
Well, this is interesting because I'm actually working on an investigation at the moment looking at the origins of ISIS much more deeply. And of course, I've been very involved in documenting the role of the Gulf states in financing the groups that went on to break away from Al-Qaeda and become part of ISIS. But what's not so well known is something that I'm now beginning to discover is the role of Israel in courting ISIS. And there have been many credible reports that Israel has actually established military hospitals in areas like the Golan Heights, where ISIS have been operating. That Israel has also, Israeli NGOs have actually run these kind of they've run so-called humanitarian operations where they've delivered aid to rebel areas in Syria, which have actually been controlled by groups that have gone on to form ISIS. And there's even some indication that there may have been some direct or indirect military and logistical support to groups that went on to form the ISIS group from Israel. And that has come in the form of actually airstrikes on groups that have been fighting ISIS, the more secular rebel factions in Syria, and actually trying to weaken them and therefore have the result of ISIS being more empowered. So there are these very worrying kind of subtle indications. And of course, you know, the first question that comes to mind is why on earth would the IDF be in any way kind of supporting this kind of group? But it kind of comes down to something that an Israeli general said, and he was quoted in the New York Times about 6 months ago or so. And he basically said something like, you know, we wanted to kind of get rid of, it would be ideal to get rid of Assad, but in the event that we can't remove Assad, we will settle for having Syria basically be plunged into continual destabilized chaos. The words he said were very, very similar to the strategy, the divide and rule strategy that was actually mentioned explicitly in this U.S. Army commissioned RAND report. And he said that we would maybe see that let the kind of civil war in Syria continue to brew rather than having any particular side win until both of the sides weaken each other. So we have Hezbollah and we have Al-Qaeda, we have Iran and the Gulf states, all of them kind of getting involved and fighting each other. So Israel's kind of sitting there thinking, well, you know, the more chaos we have in the region, the more these guys are fighting each other and blowing things up and becoming destabilized, the less interested they'll be in Israel, the less concerned they'll be by Israel. And it's worth noting, actually, that there has been no criticisms of Gaza and what's been going on in Gaza from any of these ISIS factions. That, you know, they've said some really ridiculous statements about wanting to fly the flag over White House and things like that. No, there's been no criticism of Israel, which is slightly bizarre, given the centrality of the Israel-Palestine conflict traditionally to kind of, you know, the kind of grievances that tend to motivate these Islamist groups. So that's an indication, I think, that there is that Israel is kind of sitting in this situation and seeing how it can exploit it strategically.
Well, as we wrap up, I wanted to ask you a question. I couldn't help but notice your hero's name is David Ariel. Very biblical in origin. Is there a reason for that?
Well, that is interesting because one thing I wanted to do with writing this story was have a story which wasn't too kind of ethnically loaded. And I don't know how much you're kind of familiar with this kind of phenomenon as a black journalist. And I'm obviously, you know, ethnically Bangladeshi, I'm a Muslim by faith. And one thing I've seen as a journalist myself is that you often get pigeonholed into having to write about, you know, Muslim issues or ethnic minority issues, and we're not allowed to talk about, you know, as black people or ethnic people, we're not allowed to talk about the big issues that, you know, other you know, majority communities maybe talk about. And it's not so much anyone that says you're not allowed to talk about it, but they're not really open to maybe hearing that perspective. But so what I actually wanted to do something when I wrote this book, I didn't want to do a thing of I want to have like an ethnic character, and because I'm going to basically promote ethnic writing and ethnic characters. I thought, well, actually, I want to write about a white person. I don't want to have to be pigeonholed. So I have lots of different characters in my book, and there are some ethnic characters and there are some Muslim characters, and I thought it was important to ensure that there was a diversity of different characters, you know, men, women from, you know, right. Ethnic background. But yeah,
I just thought it was interesting, you know, David being the biblical king of Israel and Ariel meaning lion of God. So
well,
I thought,
there is
wow,
a
went kind of biblical on us here.
There is an interesting thing behind that, but there's hints of it maybe in the book towards the end, and this is supposed to be the first of a trilogy, and I'm hoping to bring forward that kind of stuff a bit more. But don't worry, I'm not kind of trying to covertly convert anybody to the Bible or anything, but actually David Ariel himself, he's basically he's ethnically Jewish. He was brought up as a Christian, and he's now kind of an agnostic guy, but he's also but he has a spiritual kind of grounding. So that's his character. So I deliberately kind of wanted to have
just,
a kind of
just
interesting
throw people
dynamic.
Off.
Yeah, yeah, I wanted to throw people off a little bit.
Well, thank you so much, Nafiz Ahmed, for being with us today. This was an enlightening but too short a visit. Let's hope we can arrange something far more comprehensive, especially when you complete your current studies. I look forward to having you with us again today, but this was extremely enlightening, and I want to thank you for it. The book is Zero Point by our wonderful guest today, and I wish that you would get a copy. It's already on, this is released since last week, so it's available, right?
That's right, yeah, it's out now.
That's right. So thanks again. Give us a call, give us a note, send us a note at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know how these programs are resonating with you. Or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Up next is The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. And as always, a pleasure and a privilege to be in your company.